Find Me by Andre Aciman. Narrated for you by Michael Stuhlbarg. Tempo. Why so glum? I watched her get on at the station in Florence. She slid open the glass door and, once inside the car, looked around, then right away dumped her backpack on the empty seat next to mine. She took off her leather jacket, put down the English language paperback she was reading, then placed a square white box on the luggage rack and threw herself onto the seat diagonally across from mine in what seemed a restless, ill-tempered huff. She reminded me of someone who just had a heated argument seconds before boarding and was still stewing over the cutting words either she or someone else had spoken before hanging up. Her dog, which she was trying to keep tucked between her ankles while holding a red leash looped around her fist, seemed no less jittery than she was.
"Buona, good girl,"
she finally said, hoping to calm it down.
"Buona,"
she repeated, as the dog still fidgeted and tried to squirm out of the firm grip. The presence of the dog annoyed me, and instinctively I refused to uncross my legs or budge to make room for it, but she didn't seem to notice either me or my body language. Instead, she immediately rummaged through the backpack, found a slim plastic bag, and took out two tiny bone-shaped treats for the dog, then laid them in her palm and watched the dog lick them off.
"Brava!"
With the dog momentarily placated, she half lifted herself to fix her shirt, shifted in her seat once or twice, then slumped into a sort of upset stupor, staring out indifferently at Florence as the train began to pull out of the Santa Maria Novella station. She was still stewing and perhaps without noticing shook her head once, twice, obviously still cussing whomever she'd quarreled with before boarding. For a moment she looked so totally forlorn that while staring at my open book I caught myself struggling to come up with something to say, if only to help diffuse what had all the bearings of a gathering storm about to erupt in our little corner at the very end of the car. And I thought twice about it. Better to leave her alone and go on with my reading. But when I caught her looking at me, I couldn't help myself. "Why so glum?" I asked. Only then did it occur to me how thoroughly inappropriate my question must have sounded to a complete stranger on a train, to say nothing of one who seemed ready to explode at the slightest provocation. All she did was stare at me with a baffled, hostile glint in her eyes that presaged the very words about to cut me down and put me in my place. "Mind your own business, old man." Or, "What's it to you, anyway?" Or she'd make a face and utter a withering rebuke, "Jerk." "No, not glum. Just thinking," she said. I was so taken aback by the gentle, almost rueful tone of her reply that I was left more speechless than if she'd told me to fuck off. "Maybe thinking makes me look glum." "So yours are happy thoughts?" "No, not happy either," she replied. I smiled, but said nothing, already regretting my shallow, patronizing banter. "But maybe glum after all," she added, conceding the point with a subdued laugh. I apologized for sounding tactless. "No need," she said, already scanning the beginnings of the countryside outside the window. "Was she American?" I asked. "She was." "Me too," I said. "I could tell from your accent," she added with a smile. I explained that I'd been living in Italy for almost 30 years, but couldn't for the life of me undo the accent. When I asked, she replied she had settled in Italy with her parents when she was 12. "We were both headed for Rome." "For work?" I asked. "No, not work. It's my father. He's not well." then raising her eyes at me. Might explain the glumness, I suppose. Is it serious? I think so. I'm sorry, I said. She shrugged her shoulders. Life. Then changing her tone, and you? Business or pleasure? I smiled at the mock formulaic question and explained that I had been invited to give a reading to university students. But I was also meeting my son, who lived in Rome and was picking me up at the station. Surely a sweet boy. I could tell she was being facetious, but I liked her breezy and formal manner that skidded from sullen to sprightly and assumed minded as well. Her tone jibed with her casual clothes. Scuffed hiking boots, a pair of jeans, no makeup, and a half-unbuttoned faded reddish lumberjack shirt worn over a black t-shirt. And yet, despite the rumpled look, she had green eyes and dark eyebrows. She knows, I thought. She knows. Probably knows why I made that silly comment about her glumness. I was sure strangers were always finding one pretext or another to start a conversation with her, which explains that irritated don't-you-even-try look she projects wherever she goes. After her ironic comment about my son, I was not surprised to find our conversation lagging. Time to pick up our respective books. But then she turned to me and asked point-blank, "Are you excited about seeing your son?" Again, I thought she was ribbing me somehow, but her tone was not flippant. There was something at once alluring and disarming in the way she got personal and cut straight through the hurdles between strangers on a train. I liked it. Perhaps she wanted to know what a man almost twice her age felt before meeting his son, or perhaps she simply didn't feel like reading. She was waiting for me to answer. So are you happy, maybe? Nervous, maybe? Not really nervous, or just a bit, perhaps, I said. A parent is always scared of being an imposition, to say nothing of a bore. You think you're a bore? I loved that what I just said had caught her by surprise. Maybe I am, but then let's face it, who isn't? I don't think my father is a bore. Had I perhaps offended her? Then I take it back, I said. She looked at me and smiled. Not so fast. She prods, then drills right through you. In this, she reminded me of my son. She was slightly older, but had the same ability to call out all my gaffes and cagey little ploys, leaving me scuttled after we'd argued and made up. What kind of person are you when someone gets to know you, I wanted to ask. Are you funny, jovial, playful? Or is there a glum, ill-tempered serum coursing in your veins that clouds your features and blots out all the laughter promised by that smile and those green eyes? I wanted to know because I couldn't tell. I was about to compliment her on her ability to read people so well when her phone rang. Boyfriend, of course. What else? I'd grown so used to constant cell phone interruptions that it was no longer possible for me to meet students over coffee or talk to my colleagues or to my son even without a mobile phone call barging in. Saved by the phone, silenced by the phone, shunted by the phone. "Hi, Pa," she said as soon as it rang. I believed she was picking up the phone right away to prevent the loud chime from disturbing other passengers, but what surprised me was how she yelled into her phone, "It's the damn train! It stopped. I've no idea for how long, but should be no more than 2 hours. See you soon." The father was asking her something. "Of course I did, you old goon. How could I forget?" He asked something else. "That too." Silence. "Me too. Lots and lots." She clicked off the phone and tossed it into her backpack as if to say, "We're not going to be interrupted again." She gave me an uneasy smile. parents, she finally said, meaning the same everywhere, aren't they? But then she explained. I see him every weekend. I'm his weekend Walla. My siblings and his caregiver take care of him weekdays. Before giving me a chance to say another word, she asked, so did you prettify yourself for tonight's event? What a way to describe what I wore. Do I look prettified? I replied, bandying the word back at her in jest so she'd not think I was fishing for compliments. Well, the pocket square, the well-pressed shirt, no tie, but then the cufflinks. I'd say you gave it some thought. Old school a bit, but dapper. We both smiled. Actually, I have this, I said, half removing a colorful necktie from my jacket pocket and slipping it back in. I wanted her to see that I had enough of a sense of humor to poke fun at myself. Just as I thought, she said. Prettified. Not like a retired professor in Sunday clothes, but almost. So, what do the two of you do in Rome? Was she ever going to let up? Had I started something with my initial question that had made her think we could be so informal? We meet every 5 or 6 weeks. He's been living in Rome, but will soon be moving to Paris. I miss him already. I like spending the day with him. We do nothing, really. Mostly walk. Though it usually turns out to be the same walk. His Rome by the conservatory, my Rome, where I used to live as a young teacher. Eventually, we'll always have lunch at Armando's. He puts up with me, or maybe he enjoys my company, I still can't tell. Maybe both. But we've ritualized these visits. Via Vittoria, via Belsiana, via del Babuino. Sometimes we wander off all the way to the Protestant cemetery. They're like the markers of our lives. We've nicknamed them our vigils, after the way pious people stop at various Madonnelle, street shrines, to pay homage to the Madonna of the street. Neither of us forgets. Lunch, walk, vigils. I'm lucky. Walking around Rome with him is itself a vigil. Everywhere you turn, you stumble on memories, your own, someone else's, the city's. I like Rome at twilight. He likes it afternoons. And there have been times when we'll have an afternoon tea, anywhere, just to drag things out a bit till evening sets in and we have drinks. And that's it? That's it. We'll walk via Marguta for me, then via Balsiana for him. Old loves in both our cases. Vigils of past vigils, joked the young woman on the train. Is he married? No. Does he have someone? I don't know. I suspect there must be someone. But I do worry about him. There was someone quite a while back, and I did ask if there was anyone now, but all he did was shake his head and say, don't ask, Papa, don't ask. It meant no one or everyone, and I couldn't tell which was worse. He used to be so open with me. I think he was being honest with you. Yes, in a way. I like him, said the young woman sitting diagonally across from me. Maybe because I'm very much the same. Sometimes I'm blamed for being too open, too forward, and then for being too guarded and withdrawn. I don't think he's withdrawn with others, but I don't think he's very happy. I know how he feels. Isn't there someone in your life? If you only knew. What? I asked. The words sprung out of me like a surprised and doleful sigh. What could she mean? That there was no one in her life? Or that there were too many? Or that the man in her life had walked out on her and left her devastated with nothing but an urge to take out her anger on herself or on a succession of beaux? Or did people simply come and go, as I feared so many did with my own son? Or was she the sort who slips in and out of people's lives without leaving a trace or a keepsake? I don't know if I'm the type who even likes people, much less falls in love with them. I could just see it in the two of them, the same embittered, impassive, injured hearts. Is it that you don't like people, or that you just grow tired of them and can't for the life of you remember why you ever found them interesting? She was suddenly quiet, looked totally startled, and didn't utter a word. Her eyes stared straight at me. Had I offended her again? How could you have known that? She finally asked. This was the first time I'd seen her turn serious and look cross. I could see her wetting some well-honed words with which to cut down my presumptuous meddling into her private life. I shouldn't have said anything. We've met no more than 15 minutes ago, and yet you know me. How could you have known this about me? Then, catching herself, how much do you charge an hour? On the house. But if I know anything, it's because I think we're all like that. Plus, you're young and you're beautiful, and I'm sure men gravitate to you all the time, so it's not that you have a hard time meeting someone. Had I once again spoken out of turn and crossed a line? To walk back the compliment, I added, it's just that the magic of someone new never lasts long enough. We only want those we can't have. It's those we lost, or who never knew we existed, who leave their mark. The others barely echo. Is this the case with Miss Marguta? She asked. This woman doesn't miss a beat, I thought. I like the name Miss Marguta. It cast whatever existed years ago between us in a mild and docile, almost laughable light. I'll never really know. We were together for so short a while, and it happened so fast. How long ago? I thought for a moment. I'm ashamed to say. Oh, just say it! At least 2 decades, well, almost 3. And? We met at a party when I was a teacher in Rome. At the time, she was with someone, I was with someone. We happened to speak, neither wished to stop. Eventually, she and her boyfriend left the party, and soon after, we left as well. We didn't even exchange numbers. But I couldn't put her out of my mind. So I called the friend who invited me to the party and asked if he had her phone number. And here is the joke. A day earlier, she'd called him to ask for my phone number. I heard you were looking for me, I said when I finally called her. I should have introduced myself, but I wasn't really thinking. I was nervous. She recognized my voice right away, or perhaps our friend had already warned her. I was going to call you, she said. But you didn't, I replied. No, I didn't. Which is when she said something that showed she had more courage than I, and it sent my pulse racing because I didn't expect it and will never forget it. So how do we do this? She asked. How do we do this? With that one sentence, I knew my life was being pushed out of its familiar orbit. No one I knew had ever directed such frank, almost feral words at me. I like her. What was there not to like? Blunt and forward, and so to the point that I had to make a decision right then and there. Let's have lunch, I said. Because dinner is difficult, right? She asked. I loved the bold, implicit irony in what she'd said. Let's have lunch as in today, I said. As in today it is. We laughed at the speed with which things were happening. Lunch that day was scarcely an hour away. Did it bother you that she meant to cheat on her boyfriend? No. Nor did it bother me that I was doing the same thing. The lunch lasted a long time. I walked her to her home on Via Marguta, and she walked me back to where we'd had lunch, and then I walked her back to her home again. Tomorrow? I asked, still uncertain whether I wasn't pushing things. Absolutely. Tomorrow. It was the week before Christmas, By Tuesday afternoon, we did something totally crazy. We bought 2 plane tickets and flew to London. So romantic. Everything went so fast and felt so natural that neither saw the need to discuss the matter with our partners or give them a second thought. We simply let go all our inhibitions. In those days, we still had inhibitions.
You mean unlike today?
I wouldn't know.
No, I suppose you wouldn't.
Her oblique taunt let me know I was meant to be slightly riled. I chuckled. She did as well, her way of signaling that she knew I was being disingenuous. In any event, it ended right away. She went back to her boyfriend and I to my girlfriend. We did not remain friends. But I attended their wedding, and eventually I invited them to ours. They stayed married. We didn't. Voila.
Why did you let her go back to her boyfriend?
Why? Perhaps because I was never totally persuaded by my feelings. I just didn't fight to keep her, which she already knew I wouldn't. Perhaps I wanted to be in love, and feared I wasn't, and preferred our little limbo in London to facing up to what I didn't feel for her. Perhaps I preferred to doubt rather than know. So how much do you charge per hour?
Touché.
When was the last time I'd spoken to someone like this? So tell me about the person in your life, I said. I'm sure you're seeing someone special right now.
Seeing someone, yes.
For how long?
Then I stopped short. If I may ask.
You may ask.
Barely 4 months.
Then shrugging her shoulders, doesn't merit writing home about.
Do you like him?
I like him fine. We get along.
And we like many of the same things, but we're just 2 roommates pretending we have a life together.
We don't.
What a way to put it.
2 roommates pretending to have a life together.
Sad.
It is sad.
But what's also sad is that in these past few moments, I may have shared more with you than in a whole week with him.
Maybe you're not the kind who opens up to people.
But I'm speaking with you.
I'm a stranger. And with strangers, opening up is easy.
The only ones I can speak frankly with are my father and Pavlova, my dog. And neither is going to be around much longer. Besides, my father hates my current boyfriend.
Not so unusual for a father.
Actually, he worshipped my previous boyfriend.
Did you?
She smiled, already anticipating that she'd toss off her answer with a dash of humor.
No, I didn't.
She thought for a moment.
My previous boyfriend wanted to marry me. I told him no. I was so relieved that he didn't make a fuss when we broke up.
Then not 6 months later, I heard he was getting married. I was livid. If I was ever hurt and cried for love, it was on the day I heard he was marrying a woman we had spent hours and months making fun of when we were together.
Silence. Jealous without being the slightest bit in love.
You are difficult, I finally said.
She gave me a look that was at once veiled reproof for daring to speak this way about her and bewildered curiosity that wished to know more.
I've known you for less than an hour on a train, and yet you totally understand me. I like it. But I might as well tell you of this other terrible defect.
What now? We both laughed.
I never stay close with anyone I've had a relationship with.
Most people don't like to burn bridges. I seem to blow them up, probably because there wasn't much of a bridge to start with. Sometimes I leave everything behind in their apartment and simply disappear. I hate the drawn-out process of packing up and moving out and those unavoidable postmortems that turn into teary-eyed pleas to stay together. Above all, I hate the lingering pretense of an attachment after we don't even want to be touched by someone we no longer recall wanting to sleep with.
You're right, I don't know why I start with anyone. The sheer annoyance of a new relationship. Plus the small home habits I need to put up with. Smell of his birdcage. The way he likes his CDs stacked. The sound of an ancient radiator in the middle of the night that wakes me but never him. He wants to shut the windows. I like them open. I'll drop my clothes wherever he wants our towels folded and put away. He likes the tube of toothpaste squeezed neatly from the bottom up. I squeeze it whatever way I can and always lose the cap, which he always finds somewhere on the floor behind the toilet bowl. The remote control has its place. The milk needs to stand close, but not too close to the freezer. Underwear and socks belong in this drawer, but not that drawer. And yet I'm not difficult. I'm actually a good person, just a bit opinionated. But it's only a front. I put up with everyone and everything, at least for a while. Then one day it just hits me. I don't want to be with this guy. Don't want him near me. Need to get away. I fight this feeling. But as soon as a man senses this, he'll hound me with despairing puppy eyes. Once I spot that look, I'm gone, and immediately find someone else. Men, she finally said, as though that one word summed up all the shortcomings most women are willing to overlook and learn to put up with and ultimately forgive in the men they hope to love for the rest of their lives, even when they know they won't. I hate to see anyone hurt. A shadow hovered over her features. I wished I could touch her face, gently. She caught the glance. I lowered my eyes. Once again, I noticed her boots. Wild, untamed boots. As though they'd been dragged on craggy treks and acquired an aged, weather-worn look, which meant she trusted them. She liked her things worn and broken in. She liked comfort. Her thick navy woolen socks were men's socks, probably lifted from the drawer of the man she claimed she had no love for. But the mid-season leather biker's jacket looked very expensive. Prada, most likely. Had she dashed out of her boyfriend's home and, in her hurry, thrown on the first item at hand with a hasty, "I'm heading out to my dad's, call you this evening." She was wearing a man's watch. His too? Or did she just prefer men's watches? Everything about her suggested something gritty, rugged, unfinished. And then I caught a sliver of skin between her socks and the cuff of her jeans. She had the smoothest ankles. "Tell me about your father," I said. "My father? He's not doing well, and we're losing him." Then she interrupted herself. "Do you still charge by the hour?" As I said, confiding comes easier between strangers who'll never meet again. "You think so?" "What, confiding on a train?" "No, that we'll never meet again." "What are the chances?" "True, very true." We exchanged smiles. "So go on about your father." "I've been thinking about this. My love for him has changed. It's no longer a spontaneous love, but a brooding, cautious, caregiver's love. Not the real deal. Still, we are very open with each other, and there is nothing I'm ashamed to tell him. My mother left almost 2 decades ago, and since then it's been just him and me. He had a girlfriend for a while, but now he lives alone. Someone comes to take care of him, cooks, does his laundry, cleans, and tidies up. Today is his 76th birthday. Hence the cake," she said, pointing to the square white box resting on the top bin. She seemed embarrassed by it, which may be why she threw in a tiny giggle when she pointed to it. "He said he invited 2 friends for lunch, but he still hasn't heard from them. And my guess is they won't show up. No one does these days. Neither will my siblings. He likes profiteroles from an old shop not far from where I live in Florence. It reminds him of better days when he used to teach there once. He shouldn't have anything sweet, of course, but she didn't need to finish the sentence. The silence between us lasted a while. And once again, I made a motion to pick up my book, convinced we were done talking this time. A bit later, with my book still open, I started looking out at the rolling Tuscan landscape and my mind began to drift. An odd and shapeless thought about how she'd changed seats and was now sitting next to me began to settle on my mind. I knew I was dozing off. "You're not reading," she said. Then, seeing she might have disturbed me, she immediately added, "I can't either." "Tired of reading," I said. "Can't focus." "Is it interesting?" she finally asked, looking at the cover of my book. "It's not bad. Rereading Dostoevsky after many years can be a bit disappointing." "Why?" "Have you read Dostoevsky?" "Yes, I adored him when I was 15. "So did I. His vision of life is one that an adolescent can immediately grasp. Tormented, filled with contradictions and lots of bile, venom, shame, love, pity, sorrow, and spite. And the most disarming acts of kindness and self-sacrifice. All of it so unevenly thrust together. To the adolescent I was, Dostoevsky was my introduction to complex psychology. I thought I was a thoroughly confused person, but all his characters were no less confused. I felt at home. My sense is that one learns more about the blotchy makeup of human psychology from Dostoevsky than from Freud, or any psychiatrist for that matter." She was silent. "I see a shrink," she finally said, with an almost audible rise of protest in her voice. Had I yet again snubbed her without meaning to? "I see one too," I rejoindered, perhaps to take back what might have seemed an unintended slight. We stared at each other. I liked her warm and trusting smile. It suggested something frail and genuine, perhaps even vulnerable. No wonder the men in her life closed in on her. They knew what they were losing the moment she turned her eyes away. Out went the smile, or the languor when she asked heart-to-heart questions while staring with those piercing green eyes that never let up. Out the disquieting need for intimacy that her glance tore out of every man when your eyes happened to lock on her in a public space and you knew, there went your life. She was doing it right now. She made intimacy want to happen, made it easy, as if you'd always had it in you to give and were craving to share it, but realized you'd never find it in yourself unless it was with her. I wanted to hold her, touch her hand, let a finger drift along her forehead. "So why the shrink?" she asked, as though she had pondered the idea and found it totally bewildering. "If I may ask," she added, smiling as she parodied my own words. Obviously, she wasn't used to a softer, more congenial approach when speaking to a stranger. I asked why she was surprised I was seeing a shrink. "Because you look so settled, so prettified." "Hard to say. Maybe because the empty spaces of adolescence, when I discovered Dostoevsky, never got filled. I once believed they'd be filled at some point. Now I am not sure such spaces are ever filled. Still, I want to understand. Some of us never jumped to the next level. We lost track of where we were headed and as a result, stayed where we started. So this is why you're rereading Dostoevsky?" I smiled at the aptness of the question. "Perhaps because I am always trying to retrace my steps back to a spot where I should have jumped on the ferry boat headed to the other bank called life, but ended up dawdling on the wrong wharf or, with my luck, took the wrong ferry boat altogether. It's all an older man's game, you know. You don't sound like the sort of person who takes the wrong ferry. Did you? Was she teasing me? I was thinking of this when I boarded the train in Genoa this morning because it occurred to me that perhaps there were one or two ferry boats I should have sailed on instead and never did. Why didn't you? I shook my head, then shrugged my shoulders to suggest I didn't know why or didn't want to say. Aren't those the absolute worst scenarios, the things that might have happened but never did, and might still happen, though we've given up hoping they could? I must have looked at her with totally baffled eyes. Where did you ever learn to think this way? I read a lot. Then with a self-conscious glance, I like talking to you. She paused a moment. So was your marriage the wrong ferry boat? This woman was brilliant. And she was beautiful. And she thought along the same twisted, meandering paths I took sometimes. At first, no, I replied. Or at least I didn't want to see it that way. But after our son left for the States, there was so little between us that it felt as though his entire childhood was nothing more than a dress rehearsal for our unavoidable separation. We barely talked, and when we did, it seemed we seldom spoke the same language. We were exceptionally cordial and kind, but even when we were in the same room, we felt so alone together. We'd sit at the same dining table but weren't eating together, slept in the same bed but not together, watched the same programs, traveled to the same cities, shared the same yoga instructor, laughed at the same jokes but never together, and sat side by side at crowded movie theaters but never rubbed elbows. There came a time when I'd spot two lovers kissing on the street or even hugging and didn't know why they were kissing. We were alone together, until one day one of us broke the pickle dish. Pickle dish? Sorry, Edith Wharton. She left me for someone who was my best friend, and who is still my friend. The irony is that I wasn't in the least bit sorry she'd found someone. Maybe because it freed you to find someone else. I never did. We stayed good friends, and I know she worries about me. Should she? No. So, why the shrink? I asked, eager to change the subject. Me? Loneliness. I can't stand being by myself, yet I can't wait to be alone. Look at me. I am alone here on a train, happy to be with my book, away from a man I won't ever love. But I would much rather talk to a stranger. No offense, I hope. I smiled back, none taken. I tend to talk to everyone these days. I start conversations with the mailman just to gab a bit, but never tell my boyfriend how I feel, what I read, what I want, what I hate. In any event, he wouldn't listen, much less understand. He has no sense of humor. I need to explain every punchline to him. We continued chatting until the conductor came to collect our tickets. He looked at the dog, complained that dogs weren't allowed on the train except in cages. So what am I supposed to do? She snapped back. Throw her overboard? Pretend I'm blind? Or get off now and miss my father's 76th birthday party, which really won't be a party because it's his very last since he's actually dying? Just tell me. The conductor wished her a good day. En quel aille, she muttered. And to you too. Then turning to her dog, and stop drawing attention to yourself. Then my phone rang. I was tempted to stand up and take the call in the empty spot between the cars, but decided to stay put. The dog, stirred by the chime, was now staring at me with gaping, quizzical eyes as if to say, you too with the phone now? My son. I mouthed to my companion. who smiled at me and then, without asking, took advantage of the sudden interruption to gesture she was going to the bathroom. She handed me the leash and whispered, "She won't be any trouble." I looked at her when she stood up and for the first time realized that her rough-hewn look wasn't as dressed down as I'd initially thought, and that she was, once she stood up, more attractive yet. Had I noticed this earlier? I tried to brush the thought away? Or had I really been blind? It would have pleased me no end had my son seen me stepping off the train in her company. I knew we'd be talking about her on our way to Armando's. I could even foresee how he'd start the conversation. "So tell me about that model type you were chit-chatting with at Termini." But then, just as I was fantasizing his reaction, the phone call changed everything. He was calling to say he was not going to be able to meet me at all that day. I gasped, a plaintive, "Why?" He was replacing a pianist who'd fallen ill and had a recital in Naples that same day. When would he be back? "Tomorrow," he said. I loved hearing his voice. What was he playing? Mozart, all Mozart. Meanwhile, my companion returned from the bathroom and silently resumed her seat across from me, leaning forward, which signaled she meant to continue speaking after I'd hung up. I stared at her more intensely than I'd done during our entire trip, partly because I was busy with someone else on the phone, which gave my glance a vaguely inattentive, guileless, roaming air, but also because it allowed me to keep staring at those eyes that were so used to being stared at and that liked being stared at, and might never have guessed that if I found the courage to return her gaze as fiercely as hers was at that moment, it was also because in staring, I'd begun to nurse the impression that in her eyes, mine were just as beautiful. Definitely an older man's fantasy. There was a halt in my conversation with my son.
"But I was so counting on taking a long walk with you. This is why I took the earlier train. I came for you, not the paltry reading."
I was disappointed, but I also knew that I had my companion as an audience, and perhaps I was hamming it up a bit for her as well. Then, realizing I had gone too far with my complaint, I caught myself. "But I understand. I do." The girl seated diagonally in front of me cast an anxious look in my direction. And she shrugged her shoulders, not to display her indifference to what was happening between me and my son, but to tell me, or so I thought, to leave the poor boy alone. "Don't make him feel guilty." To the shrug, she added a gesture with her left hand to suggest I should just let it go, get over it. "So tomorrow?" I asked. "Would he come and pick me up at the hotel?" "Mid-afternoon," he replied. "Four-ish?" "Four-ish," I said. "Vigils?" he said. "Vigils," I replied. "You've heard him," I finally said, turning to her.
"I heard you."
She was taunting me again. And she was smiling. A side of me thought she'd leaned even more toward me and had thought of standing up to move to the seat next to mine and put both hands in mine. Had this crossed her mind? And was I seizing on her wish to do so? Or was I simply making it up because the wish was in me? I was looking forward to our lunch. I wanted to laugh with him and hear about his life, his recitals, his career. I was even hoping to spot him before he spotted me and that he'd find a moment to meet you. "It's not the end of the world. You'll see him tomorrow, four-ish." Yet again, I caught the jeer in her voice, and I loved it. "The irony, however," I started to add, but then changed my mind. "The irony, however?" she inquired. "She doesn't let go, does she?" I thought. I was silent for a moment. "The irony is that I'm not sorry he's not coming today. I have quite a bit to do before the reading, and maybe I could use a rest at the hotel instead of walking about the city as we normally do when I'm just visiting him." "Why should that surprise you? You lead separate lives, regardless of how they intersect or how many vigils the two of you share." I liked what she had just said. It didn't reveal anything I didn't know, but it showed a degree of thoughtfulness and care that surprised me, and didn't seem to fit the person who'd sat down in a huff on boarding the train. "How do you know so much?" I asked, feeling emboldened and staring at her. She smiled. "To quote someone I met on a train once, we're all this way." She liked this as much as I did. As we neared the Rome station, our train began to stall. Minutes later, it stirred again. "I'm taking a taxi when we get to the station," she said. "It's what I'm doing." It turned out her father's home was 5 minutes away from my hotel. He lived along the Lungo Tevere, and I was staying on Via Garibaldi, just a few steps from where I used to live years ago.
"Split a cab, then?" she said.
We heard the announcement of Roma Termini, and as the train crawled toward the station, we watched row upon row of shabby buildings and travertine warehouses come into view, each displaying old billboards and faded dirty colors. Not the Rome I loved. The sight unsettled me and made me feel ambivalent about the visit and the reading and the prospect of being back in a place that already stored too many memories. Some good, most less so. Suddenly I resolved that I'd give my reading that evening, have my de rigueur cocktail with old colleagues, then find a way to duck the usual dinner invitation and come up with something to do by myself. Maybe catch a film, and then stay indoors the next day till my son dropped by at 4. "At least I hope they booked the room with the large balcony and the view of all the domes," I said. I wanted to show, despite my son's phone call, that I knew how to look at the brighter side of things. "I'll check in, wash my hands, find a good place to have lunch, then rest."
"Why? Don't you like cake?" she asked.
"I like cake fine. Can you suggest a good spot for lunch?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"My father's. Come for lunch. Our home couldn't be closer to your hotel."
I smiled, truly moved by the spontaneous offer. She was feeling sorry for me. "That's very sweet of you, but I really shouldn't. Your father is having a cherished moment with the person he loves the most, and you want me to crash his party. Plus, he doesn't know me from Adam."
"But I know you," she said, as though this would change my mind.
"You don't even know my name.
Didn't you say Adam?"
We both laughed. "Samuel."
"Please come. It will be very simple and low-key, I promise."
Still, I couldn't accept.
"Just say yes."
"I can't." The train had finally arrived. She picked up her jacket and her book, shouldered her backpack, wrapped the dog leash around her hand, and took down the white box from the upper bin.
"This is the cake," she finally said. "Oh, just say yes."
I shook my head to convey a deferential but determined no.
"Here's what I propose. I'll pick out a fish and leafy greens on Campo dei Fiori. I always buy fish, cook fish, eat fish. And before you know it, I'll throw together an amazing lunch in no more than 20 minutes. He'll be happy to see someone new at the door."
"What makes you think he and I will have anything to say to each other? It could be terribly awkward. Besides, what do you suppose he's going to think?" It took her a moment to catch on.
"He won't think that at all," she finally said.
Clearly, it hadn't even crossed her mind.
"Besides," she added, "I'm old enough, and he's old enough to think whatever."
A moment of silence elapsed as we stepped off the train and landed on the crowded platform. I couldn't help but give a hasty and discreet look around. Perhaps my son had changed his mind and meant to surprise me after all. But no one was waiting for me on the platform. "Listen," it suddenly occurred to me, "and I don't even know your name."
"Miranda."
The name struck me. "Listen, Miranda, it's really lovely of you to invite me, but
we're strangers on a train, Sammy. And I know talk is cheap,"
she said, already fabricating a nickname for me. But I've opened up to you and you've opened up to me. I don't think either of us knows many people with whom we've been so casually honest. Let's not make this the stereotypical moment that happens on a train and then stays on a train, like an umbrella or a forgotten pair of gloves left behind somewhere. I know I'll regret it. Plus, it would make me, Miranda, very happy. I loved how she'd said this. There was a moment of silence. I wasn't hesitating, but I could right away tell she had interpreted my silence as acquiescence. Before picking up her phone to call her father, she asked if I didn't have to make a phone call as well, perhaps. Her perhaps moved me, but I wasn't sure why or what precisely it suggested. Nor did I want to speculate and be proven wrong. This girl thinks of everything, I thought. I shook my head. I didn't have anyone to call.
Pa, I'm bringing a guest, she shouted into her phone.
He mustn't have heard.
A guest, she repeated.
Then trying to keep the dog from jumping on me.
What do you mean, what kind of guest? A guest, he's a professor like you.
She turned to me to make sure she had inferred correctly. I nodded. Then the answer to the obvious question.
No, you're totally wrong. I'm bringing fish. 20 minutes, absolute max, I promise.
This should give him time to put on clean clothes, she joked. Would she ever suspect that if I had already resolved to cancel dinner with colleagues tonight, it was because, without quite admitting it to myself, I was already coddling the distant hope of having dinner with her instead? How would that ever come about?
When we arrived finally on the corner of Ponte Sisto, I asked the driver to stop. Why don't I drop my bag in my room and join you at your dad's?
Say in 10 minutes. But she grabbed my left arm as the car was about to stop.
Absolutely not. If you're anything like me, you'll check into your hotel, drop your bag in your room, wash your hands, which you said you're so eager to do, and then after letting a good 15 minutes pass, you'll call to say you've changed your mind and decide you can't come. Or you might not call at all. Maybe, if you're anything like me, you'll even find the right words to wish my father a happy birthday and mean it as well.
Aren't you like me? This, too, moved me.
Maybe.
Then if you're really anything like me, you probably like being found out. Admit it.
If you're anything like me, you're already wondering, why did I even invite this fellow?
Then I'm not like you. We both laughed.
When was the last time?
What? She asked.
Nothing.
Right.
Had she read this too?
When we got out, we rushed to Campo dei Fiori, where we found her fish vendor stand. Before ordering, she asked me to hold the leash. I was reluctant to approach the stand with the dog, but they knew her there, and she said it wasn't a problem.
What kind of fish do you like?
The easiest to cook, I replied.
How about some scallops as well? They seem to have plenty today. Are they from today's catch? She asked.
This don, replied the vendor.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure.
They'd been doing this for years. As she leaned over to inspect the scallops, I caught sight of her back. I had an impulse to put an arm around her waist, her shoulders, and kiss her on her neck and face. I looked away and instead eyed the liquor store across from the stand.
Would your father like a dry white from Friuli?
He shouldn't drink wine, but I'd love a dry white from anywhere.
I'll get a Sancerre as well.
You're not planning on killing my father, are you?
When the fish and the scallops were wrapped, she remembered the vegetables. On our way to a nearby store, I couldn't resist.
Why me? Why me what?
Why are you inviting me?
Because you like trains. Because you were stood up today. Because you asked too many questions. Because I want to know you better.
Is that so difficult? She said. I didn't press her to explain. Perhaps I didn't want to hear that she liked me no more, no less than she liked scallops or leafy greens. She found spinach. I spotted small persimmons, touched, then sniffed them, and saw that they were ripe. It was, I said, the first time this year that I'd be eating persimmons. Then you have to make a wish. What do you mean? She affected exasperation. Every time you eat a fruit for the first time that year, you need to make a wish. I'm surprised you didn't know that. I thought for a few seconds. I can't think of a wish. Some life, she said, meaning either that my life was so enviably put together that there was nothing left to wish for, or that it was so hopelessly bereft of joy that wishing something was a luxury no longer worth considering. You have to wish. Think harder. Can I yield my wish to you? I've already had my wish. When? In the taxi? What was it? How quickly we forget that you'd come for lunch. You mean you wasted a whole wish on having me over for lunch? I did, and don't make me regret it. I didn't say anything. She squeezed my arm on our way to the wine store. I decided to stop by the florist nearby. He'll love the flowers. I haven't bought flowers in years. She gave a perfunctory nod. They're not just for him, I said. Oh, no, she said, ever so lightly, almost feigning to overlook what I'd said. Her father's home was a penthouse overlooking the Tiber. He had heard the elevator coming up and was already waiting at the doorway. Only one of the doors was open, so that it was difficult to fit in with the dog, the cake, the fish, scallops, and spinach, the two bottles of wine, my duffel bag, her backpack, my bag of persimmons, and the flowers. All seemed to want to thrust their way in at the same time. Her father attempted to relieve her of some of her packages. Instead, she let him have the dog, who knew him and right away began jumping and nuzzling him. "He loves the dog more than me," she said. "I don't love the dog more than you. The dog is just easier to love." "Too subtle for me, Pa," she said. And right away didn't just kiss him, but with her hands still holding the packages, slammed into him with her whole body and kissed him on both cheeks. This, I presumed, was how she loved. Fiercely. No holds barred. Once inside, she dropped the bags, took my jacket, and laid it down neatly on the arm of a sofa in the living room. She also took my bag and placed it on the rug by the sofa, then fluffed up a large sofa cushion that seemed to bear the imprint of the head that must have been lying on it moments earlier. On her way to the kitchen, she also straightened two pictures that hung slightly lopsided against the wall, then, opening two French windows that led to the sun-baked roof terrace, complained that the living room was too stuffy on such a beautiful autumn day. In the kitchen, she cut off the bottom tips of the flower stems, found a vase, and set the flowers in it. "I love gladiolas," she said.
"So you must be the guest," said the father by way of welcome. "Piacere," he added, before reverting to English.
We shook hands, hesitated outside the kitchen, and then watched her unwrap the fish, scallops, and spinach. She rummaged through the cabinets, found the spices, and right away used the zapper to light the stove. "We are going to drink some wine, but Pa, you decide whether you want to drink it now or with the fish." He mused for a moment.
"Both now and with the fish."
"So we're already starting," she said reprovingly. Pretending to be chastened, the old man said nothing, then added an exasperated, "Daughters, what can you do?" Father and daughter spoke the same way. The father then ushered me down a corridor lined with framed pictures of past and present family members, all so formally clothed that I failed to recognize Miranda in any of them. The father was now wearing a colorful ascot under a very bright, striped pink shirt. His blue jeans were creased to a crisp, and looked as though they'd been put on minutes earlier. His long white hair was combed back and gave him the telltale look of an aging movie star. But he wore a pair of very old slippers, and obviously hadn't had time to shave. His daughter had done well to call to warn him of a visitor. The living room bore the lingering spare elegance of a Danish fad that had gone out of fashion a few decades earlier, but was on the verge of being the rage again. The ancient fireplace had been refurbished to fit in with the decor, but seemed a defunct remnant of older times in the life of the apartment. The slick white wall displayed a small abstract painting in the style of Nicolas d'Hustel. "I like that one," I finally said, trying to make conversation while staring at the view of a beach as seen on a wintry day.
"That one was given to me by my wife years ago. I didn't much like it at the time, but now I realize it's the best thing I own."
The old gentleman, I gathered, had never recovered from his divorce. "Your wife had good taste," I added, already regretting using the past tense without knowing whether I had strayed into delicate terrain. "And these here," I said, staring at three sepia-toned views of Roman life in the early 19th century, "look like Pinellis, don't they?"
"They are Pinellis," said the proud father, who might have interpreted my comment as a slight.
I'd been tempted to say imitation Pinellis, but had caught myself in time.
"I bought them for my wife, but she didn't care for them. So they're living with me now. Afterward, who knows? Maybe she'll take them back. She owns a successful gallery in Venice."
"Thanks to you, Pa."
"No, thanks to her, and only her."
I tried not to let on that I already knew his wife had left him. But then he must have guessed that Miranda had told me about their marriage.
"We're still friends," he added, by way of clarifying the situation. "Maybe good friends."
"And they," added Miranda, handing each of us a glass of white wine, "have a daughter who is constantly being tugged this way and that between them." "I'm giving you less wine than our guest, Pa," she said as she handed him his glass.
I get it, replied the father, who rested a palm on his daughter's face in a gesture that spoke all the love in the world. There was no doubt. She was lovable.
"And you know her how?"
he asked, turning to me.
"Actually, I don't know her at all," I said. "We met on the train today, basically less than 3 hours ago."
The father seemed a bit flummoxed and was awkwardly trying to conceal it.
And so
nothing, Pa. The poor guy was stood up today by his son, and I took such pity on him that I figured I'd cook him a fish, feed him vegetables, maybe throw in some limp puntarelle found in your fridge, and send him packing to his hotel where he can't wait to nap and wash his hands of us.
All three of us burst out laughing.
"This is how she is. How I managed to put such a prickly urchin on the face of our planet is simply beyond me."
"Best thing you ever did, old man. But you should have seen Sammy's face when he realized he was being stood up."
"Did I look that terrible?" I asked.
"She exaggerates, as always," he said.
"He's been pouting ever since I got on the train in Florence."
"I wasn't pouting when you got on in Florence," I said, miming her words.
"Oh, you were so pouting.
Even before we started speaking, you didn't even want to make room for my dog when I boarded. Think I didn't notice?"
Once again, we all laughed.
"Don't mind her. She's always needling people. Her way of warming up."
Her eyes were glued on me. I liked that she was trying to read my reaction to what her father had just said. Or maybe she was just looking at me. And I liked this too. When was the last time indeed?
On another wall of the living room hung a series of framed black and white photographs of ancient statues, all in striking gradations of black, gray, silver, and white shades. When I looked back at her,
Both father and daughter caught my glance.
They're all Miranda's. She took them.
So this is what you do? This is what I do, she apologized, almost as though saying, this is all I know how to do. I regretted how I'd phrased my question.
Black and whites only. Never color, added her father. She travels the world. She's gone to Cambodia, Vietnam, then Laos, Thailand, which she loves. But she is never happy with her work. I couldn't resist.
Is anyone happy with their work?
Miranda threw me a token smile of appreciation for coming to her aid.
But her look might as well have meant, nice try, I don't need rescuing.
I had no idea you were a photographer, they're amazing.
Then seeing she wasn't taking the compliment, I added, they're stunning.
What did I tell you? Never happy with herself. You can beat your head senseless and she still won't accept a compliment. She has a wonderful offer to work for a large agency,
which she isn't going to accept, she said.
We're not discussing this, Pa.
Why?
He asked.
Because Miranda loves Florence, she said.
We both know that her reason has nothing to do with Florence, said the father, playing up the humor, but casting a significant look at his daughter and then at me. It has to do with her father, he said.
You're so pig-headed, Pa, that you're convinced you're the center of the universe and that without your blessing, every evening star in heaven would snuff out its light and turn to ash, she said.
Well, this pig-headed man needs a bit more wine before he turns to ashes, which, remember, Mira, is what I specified in my will.
Not so fast, she said, pushing the open bottle away from her father's reach.
What she fails to understand because of her age, I suppose, is that past a certain point, dieting and watching what you eat or drink serve no purpose and actually cause more harm than good. I think people our age should be allowed to live out the term of their life as they wish. Depriving us of what we want at death's door seems pointless, if not totally evil, don't you think?
I think one should always do what one wants, I said, begrudging having been put in the father's camp. So speaks the man who knows exactly what he wants, right? Was the ironic broadside coming from the daughter who hadn't forgotten our conversation on the train.
How would you know whether I know or don't know what I want? I shot back.
She didn't answer. She just looked at me and didn't lower her eyes. She wasn't playing my little cat-and-mouse game. Because I'm the same way, she finally said. She'd seen right through me, and she knew that I knew it. What she may not have guessed was that I loved our playful sparring and her unwillingness to let anything slip by if it came from me. It made me feel unusually important, as if we'd known each other forever and our familiarity in no way diminished our mutual regard. I needed to caress her, to put my arms around her.
Today's youth is too bright for the likes of us, intervened the father.
Neither of you knows the first thing about today's youth, came the girl's quick reply.
Had I once again been inducted into her father's nursing home universe sooner than my age allowed?
Well, then here is one more glass of wine for you, Pa, because I love you. And more for you as well, Mr. S.
They don't serve wine where I'm headed, my love, white or red or even rosé, and frankly I want to down as much of it before they wheel away the gurney. Then I'll sneak a bottle or two under the sheet so that when I finally get to meet his lordship, I'll say, here, see what goodies I brought you from confounded planet Earth.
She did not reply, but returned to the kitchen to bring lunch to the dining room. But then she changed her mind and said it was warm enough for the three of us to eat on the veranda. We each took our glasses and our silverware and proceeded to the terrace. Meanwhile, she split open the branzini she had broiled in a cast-iron frying pan, removed their bones, and on a different plate came the spinach and old puntarelle, over which, once we were seated, she sprinkled oil and freshly grated Parmesan.
"So, tell us what you do," said the father, turning to me.
I told them that I had just finished working on my book and would soon head back to Liguria, where I lived. I gave them a very hasty outline of my career as a professor of classics and of my current project on the tragic fall of Constantinople in 1453. I told them about my life a bit, about my ex-wife, who lives in Milan now, about my son, who has a rising career as a pianist, and then told them how much I miss waking up to the sea when I'm away. The fall of Constantinople interested her father.
"Did the residents know their city was doomed?"
asked the father. "They knew."
"So why didn't more of them flee before it was sacked?"
"Ask the Jews of Germany." There was a moment of silence.
"You mean ask my parents and grandparents and most of my aunts and uncles whom I'll encounter at the pearly gates?"
I was unable to tell whether Miranda's father was administering a cold shower after what I'd just said, or whether this was just another not-so-veiled reference to his declining health. Either way, I wasn't scoring points.
"Knowing that the end is near is one thing," I added, trying to navigate a tactful course over the shoals, "but believing it is quite another. Tossing one's entire life overboard to start from scratch in a foreign land may be a heroic act, but it is totally reckless. Not many are capable of it. Where do you turn when you feel trapped and caught in a vice, when there is no exit and the house is on fire and your window is on the fifth floor so that plunging isn't really an option? There is no other bank. Some people choose to take their own lives. Most, however, prefer to wear blinkers and live off hope. The streets of Constantinople overflowed with the blood of the hopeful once the Turks entered the city and sacked it clean. But I'm interested in the citizens of Constantinople who feared the end and fled. Many to Venice. Would you have left Berlin if you were living there in, say, 1936, Miranda said.
I don't know. Someone would have had to push me or threaten to leave me behind if I wasn't ready to flee. I am reminded of a violinist who hid in his apartment in the Marais in Paris, knowing that the police would come knocking at his door one night. And knock one night they did. He even managed to convince them to let him take his violin with him, and they did. But it was the first thing they took away from him. They killed him, not in a gas chamber. Instead, in the camps, they beat him to death.
"So your reading this evening will be about Constantinople?" she asked, almost with an incredulous inflection in her voice that made her sound disappointed.
It was not clear whether she meant to trivialize my work by asking the sort of question I'd just asked about hers, or whether she was filled with admiration, meaning, "How wonderful that this should be your life's work." Which is why I ended up answering with a meek and evasive, "That's what I do. But there are days when I am able to see my vocation for what it is, desk work, just desk work. I'm not always proud of this."
"So your life is not spent traipsing through the Aeolian Islands, then settling somewhere like Panarea, swimming at dawn, riding all day, eating from the sea, drinking Sicilian wine at night with someone half your age?"
Where was this coming from? And was she making fun of what every man my age dreams of? Miranda put down her fork and lit a cigarette. I watched her shake the match with a decisive hand motion before dropping it into an ashtray. How strong and invulnerable she suddenly seemed. She was showing her other side, the one that sizes people up and makes hasty indictments, then shuts them off and never lets them back in, except when she weakens, only to hold it against them that she did. Men were like matches. They caught fire and were shaken off and dropped in the first ashtray that came her way. I watched her take in her first puff. Yes, willful and unbending.